This is Mother's Day. I wish you all a very happy Mother's Day. We have lots of mothers and grandmothers. I think when I see Pioneer Park, one of the things that blesses my heart is so many good mothers, full of mothers, that when you see two, three generations worshiping together, you know there are mothers in the house. And such a wonderful gift. I believe mothers, with all my heart, I believe are the gift God gives to the human race. These are gifts. And this story, the one that we just read, illustrates that very, very powerfully. And I would like us to consider that together. Before I do that, I found this nice, humorous, fictitious story that has some truth to it, and I want to share that with you. It's called When God Created Mothers. When the good Lord was creating mothers, he was into his sixth day of overtime when the angel appeared and said, "You're taking a lot of time on this one." And God said, "Have you read the specs on this order? She has to be completely washable, but not plastic. Have 180 movable parts, all replaceable. Run on black coffee and leftovers. Have a lap that disappears when she stands up. A kiss that can cure anything from a broken leg to a disappointed love affair. And 6 pairs of hands." The angel shook his head slowly and said, 6 pairs of hands? No way. "It's not the hands that are causing me problems," God remarked. "It's the 3 pairs of eyes that mothers have to have." "That's on the standard model?" asked the angel. God nodded. "One pair that sees through closed doors when she asks, 'What are you kids doing in there?' when she already knows. Another here in the back of her head that sees what she shouldn't, but what she has to know. And of course, the ones here in front that can look at a child when he goofs up and say, 'I understand and I love you,' without so much as a word." "God," said the angel, touching his sleeve gently, "get some rest tomorrow." "I can't," said God. "I am close to creating something so close to myself. Already I have one who heals herself when she is sick, can feed a family of 6 on 1 pound of hamburger, and can get a 9-year-old to stand under a shower." The angel circled the model of a mother very slowly. "It's too soft," she sighed. "But tough," said God excitedly. "You can't imagine what this mother can do or endure. Can it think? Not only can it think, but it can reason and compromise," said the Creator. Finally, the angel bent over and ran his finger across the cheek. "There is a leak," she pronounced. "I told you that you were trying to put too much into this model." "It's not a leak," said the Lord, "it's a tear." "What is it for?" "It's for joy, sadness, disappointment, pain, loneliness, and pride. There's something so special about mothers." Also, how so true? There is something so special about mothers. They care. Mothers care. And they give, they serve. And it's like they never get tired of giving and serving. So as I was thinking about this, I said, this is really nothing but love. But the English word love does not describe this adequately, because we, in the same breath that we say I love ice cream, we say I love my wife, I love my mother. It's really not fair. If it was the Greeks would have had multiple words that would adequately, accurately describe what this is. To care, to serve, to give is nothing but the kind of love that God has for his children. And I always wonder what some prominent people think or say about certain things, so I kind of Google it. And here's a few quotes that I found. Abraham Lincoln says this about his mother: "All that I am or ever hope to be, I owe to my angel mother. I remember my mother's prayers, and they have always followed me. They have clung to me all my life." Meryl Streep says this: "Motherhood has a very humanizing effect. Everything gets reduced to essentials." George Washington: "My mother was the most beautiful woman I ever saw. All I am, I owe to my mother. I attribute my success in life to the moral, intellectual, and physical education I received from her." And this is the one I really like the most. That is, I believe, quite accurate. This is from a man called Mitch Albom. I think he wrote something, a book on heaven, many, many years ago. I don't remember it anymore, even the title. But it says, "I realized when you look at your mother, you're looking at the purest love you will ever know." Emily Dickinson says, "Mother is the one to whom you hurry when you are troubled." And it's not easy being a mother. If it were, fathers would do it. Guess where this is from? From Dorothy on the Golden Girls. I don't know if you remember. I remember this show many years ago when I came to Canada. These four women sitting in the kitchen talking anyways. But that is fascinating. This story that we read this morning is, I mean, Matthew concludes the story by saying it's a story, making it about a great faith. He says, you know, he tells us a story, and then on verse 28, he says this: "Then Jesus said to her, 'Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted.'" I'm reading from NIV, not from James Lowen. "And her daughter was healed at that moment." So that's how he concludes it. But is this about faith? Now, if we were to find that mother and interview her, put her on CNN, right? And put a stick on mic, and she said, "I got up this morning, I knew I could feel the faith in my heart all over the place. I knew this was going to be the day my daughter was going to be healed. And I knew I was going to see Christ. I knew it was going to happen so much. And I know what great faith is like." Would she be talking in theological terms? Is that what she would say? If we were to interview Christ, is that what he would say? This is what he says. This is the man who was one of those people that were pushing the woman away. Matthew was one of them. He could not understand the mother. He was pushing away. He was rebuffing her. You know, Jesus in this occasion, he was up north. This is the only occasion where Jesus is outside of the Jewish territory, up north in present-day Lebanon. And he's getting away because the ministry was becoming too big and too distracting from his mission. He goes to this region for retreat, just to get away from it all. He did not go there for ministry, even though deep inside, I know he knew that there was a divine appointment. God is about to do something, right? And this woman who has a daughter, a young daughter, who was demon-possessed. Demon possession in those days is not a headache or some kind of cold or a flu or a backache or a migraine. Demons were filthy creatures that could cause all kinds of physical, emotional, spiritual torment. In the scripture in Luke 13, we see a woman that is hunched over, bent over for 18 years, caused by Satan. In Mark chapter 5, we see a person who was naked in tombs, in the cemetery where he is making his living place, and They would chain, they would put a chain, metal chain on his hands. And this person, because of the demons, he has the power to rip these chains apart. And demons can throw people into fire, into waters. They're violent. They're filthy creatures. And this is, imagine what this mother has been going through to trying to do something about this daughter. But she's been going all over the place. She can't find any solution, right? And she's really exhausted. She's at the end of her resources. I believe God in heaven hears the cry of a desperate person. She's crying. It is for this woman that Jesus made this 70, 80 kilometer trip well away up north from Galilee, just because he knows there is something is about to happen. I want us, as we consider this story, to ask two questions. The first is, what is motivating this mother who is an outsider, risking her reputation, her dignity, to humiliate herself before some stranger who may or may not be able to help her? What is motivating this mother? And the second question I want you to think about is, what was it that caused Jesus to say, "Woman, you have great faith"? I believe there's two things that we see. We see the heart of God working in this mother, heart of love working in this mother. And we also see this love moving the heart of God himself. These two things are interplaying in the scene that we see. This would have been a better way of capturing the story rather than making it of faith, even though it is about faith as well. What is motivating this mother was extraordinary love. The only way I can describe the God kind of love in English would be extraordinary love. That caused it for us to see this extraordinary love at work, extraordinary humility, and ultimate sacrifice is what we see in this story. In verse 22, she comes. She says, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me." She's saying, "Have mercy on me. Have compassion for me." Mercy is a word of compassion. I know I don't deserve to be with you. I don't deserve to be in front of you, Lord. Mercy, compassion. Feel what I feel. Extraordinary love feels the pain of another. She is not simply going through the motions. She is completely identifying herself with her daughter. The pain the daughter is going through, the mother is going through equally because of her love. She comes to him and says, "Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me. Son of David, I know, Lord, you can do something about this. Just feel what I feel." See, she's feeling it. There's empathy flowing out of her. Empathy is to sit along somebody, to be with someone, and to completely identify ourselves with that person. Often, people that are in pain, people are in grief, people are going through, what they are looking for is somebody that they can identify with, or somebody that identifies with them. One commentator writes this about this mother. In her heart, there was that love for her child, which is always the reflection of God's love for his children. It was love which made her approach this stranger. It was love which made her accept his silence and yet still appeal. It was love which made her suffer the apparent rebuffs. It was love which made her able to see the compassion beyond and behind the words of Jesus. Her extraordinary love made her non-self-aware. She couldn't. She is not aware of herself in a way. So it's not about self-preservation or self-interest. It is about the interest of another person totally. But interestingly, Jesus says nothing. In fact, the only response she gets is to be pushed away by the disciples who do not understand what she's going through. Jesus, on the other hand, says nothing. He never, in fact, they were trying to compel Jesus to say, tell her to go away. She is a distraction. She's a nuisance. Tell her to go away. Of course, Jesus never, rarely have I seen Jesus being compelled, pushed to do outside of what he calls timing of God. Jesus always moves with the timing of God. It could very well be a split second. And this extraordinary love pushes this woman to have to show extraordinary humility. She sees the woman came in verse 25 and knelt before him. Now she says, Lord, help me. Before she was saying, Lord, have mercy on me, have compassion. Now I know you hear me, I know you feel it, but can you do something about it? And I know you can do something about it. Can you? Will you? It's a challenge. It's saying you can't turn your back on me because you are Lord. You are the Son of David. You are the merciful one. You are the Messiah, the Savior. How can you turn back your back on me? And even if she was pushed away, even if she was rebuffed, she ups the ante. She actually bows on her knees. She goes down on her knees. She's willing to face whatever comes her way. In verse 26, 27, Jesus now finally compelled to speak. He replies, it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. Yes, it is. Listen to these words, he said. You are right because you are Lord. Whatever you can say is right. I agree with you. The word dogs, by the way, is not dogs, it's puppies. She says, yes, it is, Lord, she said. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. This is the ultimate sacrifice. She's faced the ultimate humiliation, but she's come this far. She ain't returning back. She knows she's come to the one who can do something about the situation. She is ready to lay her life for her child if necessary. If Jesus would tell her to stand on her head, she was ready to do it. I asked myself, what did she mean? What is she saying? And this is what she's saying, if human masters are able to care for their puppies, this is what she's telling him, the creator of the universe, and wisdom that is so penetrating, so powerful, she says, if human beings, human masters, are able to care for their puppies, surely you, the master, the Lord, will not turn me back. A person created in your image. A person who bears the resemblance, your image is on my spirit. You're not going to turn me away. See, now the table is turned on Jesus. This is what moves the heart of Christ. This moves. He is not talking about faith. He's talking about love. Finally said, woman, what does he say? He says, woman, you have great faith. In Galatians 5, verse 6, faith works in love. Faith works in love. He's talking about her great love. Woman, your faith is so great. Saying, I put up so much barrier. I pushed you away. I was indifferent. I was cold. He knew that Jesus understood women very, very well. And women understood Jesus. He understood women very well. He knew he found a partner he could dance with. He knew he found somebody that understands what's going on. Remember, his disciples that have been running around with him have no clue what is going on, what's taking place. You know, sometimes God is silent, but he is not deaf. He hears. His silence is just as valuable as his speech. His silence is an answer just as much as his speech. When he says, there is no shadow of turning in God, which means when God turns 360, there is no shadow. All of God is light. So all of God's silence is an answer in itself. When he's quiet, he's actually working.